This is January the 27th, 1954. This morning, I'm going to give you a process which you will have to run on an operating theme. Just has to be run. It's very much part of 8-0. Every operating thetan who operates without knowing this goes back down tone scale with great rapidity. Quite incidentally, this process will change the personality of a Homo sapiens quite markedly for the better. And it quite incidentally will break up the blackness in a case. And quite incidentally will spring these resistive fives. That's almost unimportant. There are too many things that will spring a resistive five if you go to work on it. We've too long been validating how tough it was to exteriorize. Now, when you start validating how tough it is to exteriorize, you will see in just a moment why the resistive five, once labeled, then doesn't easily exteriorize. See that? He finds out he can't exteriorize, so he doesn't exteriorize. If you weren't talking to him much about exteriorization, he would not be very concerned about it. On the other hand, if you were to describe to a resistive five how horrible it would be for him to be outside of his head, he would probably exteriorize. That's one for your clinical practice. You'll go around worrying about this fellow hard enough about how horrible it would be if he were outside of his head and he'll spring. Of course, it won't do you any good because you haven't removed the basic mechanism which made him spring. Now, this mechanism also is the reason why inversion takes place and is also the reason we have an extremely sporadic technique and why it works in negative exteriorization. You know, don't be or try not to be 3 feet back of your head. An awful lot of people immediately are 3 feet back of their head. See, they're obeying a reverse command. We'll first speak of this in the framework of a resistive five, and we find out that they have not observed that this situation is taking place. That when they try to put something out in front of them, it appears inside their head. Particularly if they try to put a no something out in front of them, then the positive thing will appear inside their head. You see that? The test technique on this, which is a very good technique in itself, just run as itself because it is right close to definitions. The definition, the messed universe, is a game consisting of barriers. We say to an individual, give me a barrier that you're absolutely certain isn't in front of your face. It's a very good technique, by the way. Give me a barrier that you're absolutely certain isn't under you. And this reversal shows up on those cases which you are finding difficult. They say, well, I'm absolutely certain Earth is under me. Whoops. That's funny. They've got no Earth if they're running this with closed eyes. They have a nothingness of Earth under them. Real peculiar, huh? Well, you wouldn't ordinarily ask them to look in the opposite direction, but they would find that it was all solid above their heads at that moment, which gives them the idea they're backwards and upside down. All right, now give me a barrier you're absolutely sure is not in front of your face. The fellow says, well, he says there's no pea soup in front of my face. No. Now, he might not notice this. Quite important. Your five doesn't look. What's mainly wrong with him? Too much looking. And as he said, no pea soup out in front of his face, if he were to look right quick at the darkness which were inside his head, he would probably find it had turned green. No pea soup means pea soup inside his head. There are no feathers. There is not a wall of feathers behind me. And at the moment he declared this, if he looked inside his head, he'd find out the inside of his head was, as blackness and so forth, had converted probably into feathers inside his head. This is fairly routine manifestation you'll find in a case. But because you as an auditor don't look inside his head, you wouldn't see if this was taking place, and he's never going to see it. Unless you call his attention to it. And you say, now, all right, now give me something that's not in front of your face. He says, there's no pea soup in front of my face. Whoops, I sort of have a feeling like there might be. I'm uncertain about that. And you listen to this chatter about his uncertainty and try to find something more certain rather than find out what did happen. Well, you say, all right, now you got that? There's no pea soup in front of your head? The fellow said, yeah, but, and so on. You say, well, look inside your head and look around that blackness. Now, on the cases that are inverted into blackness, it is quite common, this is not always the case, but it's quite common that the blackness would have turned green. It would have turned into pea soup. You see, what you've got there is somebody who has been hammered and pounded in this fashion. Put your attention on yourself, people have said to him. He said, well, I don't know. This fellow's a man, let's say, and he says, I don't know that men are very much good. He's had somebody around him who was really a pretty ravey psycho, somebody that's way down the line, and this person's immediate response to any sort of a generalized statement would probably be, well, I don't know about other men. What about you? Why don't you look at yourself when you criticize others? You're doing these very same things that you're criticized about. You know. In other words, put your attention on yourself. Which, of course, collapses his attention lines. And every time he tries to put an attention line exterior, why, somebody fixes it up so that it goes interior. See? Reversal of attention. Well, you can just have the fellow start working this as an automaticity, that there's no pea soup in front of his face, and then put pea soup inside his head. And there's no feathers above his head. And put feathers inside his head. And there's no nothingness under him, and put nothingness inside his head. He would just take this over as an automaticity. Now, that's one way of running this in a very effective way, because you're knocking out a very heavy battery of automatic machinery which reverses the direction of his intention and attention. His intention is to go outside of his head, so he goes fixedly in his head. If there's no pea soup outside, we not only get the no reversing to a plus pea soup, but we don't get it outside, we get it inside his head. In other words, we've got a double reversal at work here. If you didn't notice this double reversal, why, you wouldn't get this. I'll just give you a little example of this. Who's got a lot of blackness inside his head? You got some blackness inside your head? All right. Now, why don't you get some no molasses out in front of you? The idea that there's no wall of molasses in front of you. Look around inside your head when you did that. Manifestation hold good on you?
Doesn't seem to.
Fine. This is quite routine, however. And gives you an idea. You probably have been audited up enough so you're not on a double reversal anymore. You see, the fellow says there's no something out there. Then there's the question that there probably is something out there. And instead of out there, it's in here. See, when he says it's out there, it gets to be in here. It's a double reversal. No turns to yes, and outside turns to inside. Now, those are really, if you work around with it, the mechanics, which you're working with people who don't exteriorize easily, you see. They would exteriorize if they could make their postulate, I am now exteriorized, hold good. But they can't make that postulate hold good, so because they're on at least one of these reversals. They say, I'm now outside. And this means, of course, that they're inside. This runs on all sorts of postulates. Everything I say, I'm wrong. All kinds of... doesn't matter much what I do, I'll it's probably wrong in the long run. And various things like this. They're upside down and reversed things. But that is not what we are talking about and is not the important thing. I'm just going over inversion a little bit there. This is not the important thing. The important thing is fixation of attention. And if you cannot correct a thetan's obsessive attention fixations, he'll get himself into more trouble than you can count. To get a man into an operating thetan category, it's really, if all other things aside, it's necessary that he be able to fix and unfix his attention at will. Other things exterior to him must not fix his attention beyond his control. He must be able to fix and unfix his attention at will. Now, that's only half of it. The other half is his concept of his own power depends on whether or not he can fix and unfix the attention of other livingnesses around him at will. You see, there's two sides to it. So that would be a very, very powerful individual, one who didn't have any compulsion to fix his attention or unfix his attention beyond his own ability to regulate, and one who could fix and unfix attention of other livingnesses at will. That would be a very powerful fellow. You see that. Actually, it's simply an index of what his power would be in regulating the activity of other livingnesses. It wouldn't necessarily be an index of how well he could compose mist or fix it in place or endow it or something of the sort. But these two things go hand in groove. If an individual can do this, it generally follows that he can also fix livingness into mist itself. In other words, he can endow it life. Well, as we look over all cases, we find out that this, to some degree or other, is in error about any one of these cases. Now let's take this resistive five, and we find out that he has his attention on blackness. Now this is very peculiar, isn't it? He can't unfix his attention. See? I mean, you just want to describe his case. You say, well, he can't unfix his attention. That's the trouble with him. He's looking at blackness. Well, I assure you, the whole track and the whole universe isn't black. And if the individual could unfix his attention, why, he would be able to see the walls and see the rest of the universe. It's perfectly elementary. So what's wrong with this case? He is merely an extreme case of unable to unfix attention. The reason why is every time he tries to unfix his attention, he fixes it, which is you've got your reversal at work. When he tries to unfix his attention, he fixes it. When he tries to fix his attention, he unfixes it. Now I've got to remember this, he will say. And he's got to fix his attention on this, and what the hell was it I was trying to remember? That's his next remark. That's a reversal. Now, how'd he get that way? Well, you wouldn't quite suspect the ease with which one gets into that one. The great ease. And that's why I'm trying to fix your attention on this subject with regard to the operating thetan. Let's not let the operating thetan get into this groove. And if the thetan has gotten into this groove to the point where he is a resistive five and cannot exteriorize at will, then let's run this so as to materially reduce its effectiveness upon his case. And the answer to that, I mentioned the other day, is courage. That's how he got there. This thing called courage. Nobility processing turned this up a long time ago. But the thing called courage is on the other side of a bridge called pain from a place called cowardice. And cowardice is simply this: when you should stay, you run. See? Reversal. When you should run, you stay. You see that? A bridge called pain. So we get various inverted values in livingness. All because of what? Because of this thing called courage. Now, those people who have been in space opera have been implanted countless times to the effect that they must be courageous. The little boy growing up in this society is continually reminded that he must be courageous. The doctor under training at the hospital, looking into the stiff vat, you know, where the bodies float around, he's supposed to drag them out and cut them up to find out what they're made of, study dead tissue to find out what living tissue does. He is continually reminded that he must be courageous. He's got to have his nerve with him. A soldier in battle with bombs exploding all around is always being reminded by his top sergeant and the subalterns that he must be courageous. What is courage? Why, it's facing up to a resistance, of course. It's a swindle. But, of course, it's the first ingredient of a game. We are taught, we see on every hand, that a man without courage must not be respected. And yet the greatest respected people we know are those who are totally serene. A person who is totally serene doesn't have any courage. He isn't even vaguely worried about courage. Doesn't concern him. The coward worries continually throughout his entire lifetime about courage. This is the one thing that he must worry about. And those who are very often counted brave men have spent their lives worrying about their courage. It is something we worry about, in other words, whether brave or cowardly. They go into battle like lions, and by the time they have been hit hard enough and often enough, and if they don't get killed on the field of battle, that's when it drags them into the surgeon's tent, and sooner or later down the line someplace, they will have slid across that bridge. Well, it's the turning point in a man's life when he slides across that bridge. Afterwards, he doesn't feel like he amounts to much. As far as a woman is concerned, she is not to that degree victimized by the society, and therefore has a little bit better longevity than men. But courage is desirable in a woman, and there are various things that she has to face up to. Her body structure, however, is a little more inverted than a man's already, and so people don't worry too much about getting her to face up to things. They're not trying to stop her communication, in other words. Well, you can change the personality of any Homo sapiens simply by having him manufacture this thing called courage. You get it high enough on the scale, and you keep putting it in. Where? Somewhere in the vicinity of his body. How many hours does it take? I don't know. 20? 30? Lots of it. Because it'll up and run out an awful lot of things that are standing suspended in his vicinity. And it'll run to a point where he finally has this postulate turn up. Must fix attention upon the horrible. And you'll run that until you see that one turn up. And that fixed attention upon the horrible is probably keeping a black ridge in front of him as a Satan. He can't get away from it. Now, how do you remedy that? You remedy that, again, by increasing his havingness. You don't run this out because it won't run out. It will, however, run in and disappear. You just have him put this postulate and the thing upon which his attention is fixed into many, many things on the overt act motivator basis. That is to say, have him put somebody looking at the black ridge and his pointed toward black ridge in his side, and then put him facing the black ridge with the black ridge away from him. You understand there? Well, we got a black ridge and we got a guy. All right. Now let's set it up in such a way as the fellow is nearer than the guy, you see? I mean, we're talking about mock-up here. The individual is nearer the black ridge. Well, that's the motivator basis. You know, there's a black ridge making this person fix his attention. Now we turn around the other way, and we have the black ridge closest to the pre-clear, and somebody looking at the black ridge. Fix attention upon the horrible. I mean, that's just a geometric arrangement. I can't draw you a picture. Now put up some black ridge making you fix your attention upon it. I'll have you putting up a black ridge so somebody else's attention will be fixed upon it. Well, let's get some of the horrible things the pre-clear knows, so forth. Well, as we run this postulate back and forth, 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 we certainly better remember that we're adding to his havingness. We're not trying to run it out. We're trying to run it in. So let's put up a lot of them. And let's group them all together and let's make masses out of them. And then let's go back to having him put quantities of a serene, even contemptuous kind of courage around him. Lots of it. You'll find out the bank is greedy for it. Rather pathetic thing when you begin to think about it. It is probably one of the most, was at one time before the society went to hell, one of the most valued emotions, courage, and is certainly the most dangerous, tricky emotion for an individual to assume. Too bad. But the point is that having to face up to the horrible is the keynote of every one of these cases that keeps coming around and telling you how horrible things are. And I call your attention to 16G, where it says, "It's so bad over there." Let's go over into that, "It's bad over there." That mechanism is fix your attention upon the horrible. Now, sooner or later on the track, an individual has come up into something that was beautiful that has turned out to be horrible, or was beautiful and horrible at once, and this is hung up on the track. This can be true of night. Night can at once be beautiful and horrible. And he will have that person in suspense. Let's say this girl, she marries a very beautiful man. You know, I mean, aesthetically very, very good looking. Who is just plain rotten all the way through. You know, horrible. And boy, this poor girl have that fellow walking right around in the room with her. All her waking hours. And racking up her nightmares. Person is suspended there, you see, because fix your attention on the beautiful and fix your attention upon the horrible. Now, what she wants to do is fix her attention upon the beautiful, and every time she does, this person, who was painful to her, operates as the bridge to throw her over into fixing her attention upon the horrible. So we have what we might call the bridge personality on the case. It may not be in this lifetime, but it'll be in some lifetime. It's those things which were supposed to be beautiful but were horrible and which are in suspense. Now, the desire to fix one's attention upon the beautiful, the desire to be the effect of beautiful things, is, like courage, another entrance into facing up to existence? And is the lighter, higher level of this? And when this has become obsessive, when beauty is terribly commanding upon the individual cannot free his attention. Just to that degree, he is compulsively fixing his attention. So we slide in on the beautiful and we slide in on the horrible. And courage and appreciation of beauty are alike, when compulsive and obsessive, the entrance points into the dwindling spiral. Now, it is so common and so widespread for you to fix your attention and have your attention fixed by the beautiful. Fix your attention upon the beautiful, have your attention fixed by the beautiful. It's so common that you wouldn't think of this as a compulsion. And that's been a little sleeper, you know. I mean, it's, you know, everybody does it, and we're in such total agreement upon it that it's just about as solid as a wall. And we don't suspect a wall of being anything. But that is the upper level of how you get a wall. There's how you get these persistent solidities. Now, you would suspect from that, then, that mess itself was at once beautiful and horrible. And so it is. There's something very horrible about mess. There's also something very beautiful about mess. Well, an individual who can't fix his attention self-determinedly and unfix it gets trapped in it. Nobody's safe from a theta trap. Nobody's safe from a body, and nobody's safe from a head who cannot unfix his attention at will, who cannot turn from a beautiful scene and throw it all away. What? So it's beautiful. He should be in a situation where, when he looks at something beautiful, he should say, "Now I shall find this beautiful. Now I am gratified." Fine. Everybody runs around trying to be in effect compulsively and obsessively. An individual gets to a point, finally, where he is unable to differentiate between the beautiful and the horrible. And you get sadism, all kinds of weird things. You get the activities and conduct of a lot of people. Very strange sort of a mixture. And that in itself is the mess universe. There's something beautiful and there's something horrible about mess. The entrance point into the horrible is courage. The entrance point into the beautiful is appreciation. How do you handle these? You simply mock them up in tremendous quantity as an emotion around the preclear. You'll find to a large degree that it will dissolve its bank, and very certainly, if run for 5 or 10 hours on any case, will utterly alter his personality. Much for the better. I don't care whether he's interiorized or exteriorized, that will take place. Now, how does this represent itself in human behavior? It is terribly interesting to an auditor to be able, by some of the most casual statements of the people around him, to immediately categorize their case level. Simply by how much they insist that he put his attention upon the horrible, and, incidentally, how much they insist he put his attention upon the beautiful. People who go around insisting that you put your attention upon the beautiful are in a better state, but not much better off than people who go around insisting you put your attention upon the horrible. Now, people who go around insisting that you put your attention upon, then, is the common denominator of these two. And if they've gotten to the extremity of putting your attention on the horrible and putting your attention upon the beautiful, that's an extremity. You say, the one who insists you put your attention upon the beautiful probably has about the same sense of reality as a squirrel. Unreal. This case is groping. And the one who says you must put your attention upon the horrible probably couldn't be exteriorized unless you're willing to put some time in on the case. if you must put your attention upon the horrible. It's bad over there. Now, the supplementary reading on this are those few paragraphs regarding this in 16G, Journal of Scientology. It's bad over there. When we add this up to fixed attention and realize that the emotion we're shooting for is courage, why, it makes good sense as a process, because it does change the personality of the individual. It does shift his personality. Now, there is several little packages like this. We won't bother to go over them, because most of them are not important. But there are several little packages like this. There's nobility. Nobility is resistance against degradation. I'll give you an example of that. Put some nobility up above your head. Put some more up above your head. Put some more above your head. Put some more above your head. You notice what your nobility is doing? It's all these emotions, sure. It's being noble in the face of. Some of these characters who are being compulsively noble wouldn't stand a very close inspection on their private lives, because they have to put this up all the time, so they must have a terrific amount of degradation somewhere in their vicinity. Maybe they've got to resist it. Well, the next step is being a tramp. Now, being a tramp, it's all very well for us to deify in song and story, to coin a cliche, the great nobility of the aristocracy of Central Europe, Southern Europe, and Northern Europe. But having associated with these characters now and then, I can tell you that their main struggle is to differentiate between themselves and the canaille, the great unwashed, the this and the that. It is an emotion which, when turned upon a person, automatically classifies him as a degraded person. Best thing to do with somebody who has this kind of emotion is just what they did with them. Off with their heads. Always will wind up. It is not the prime principle of aristocracy, then, which brings forth a decline of a nation. The prime principle that there are some brilliant or well-blooded or well-placed or well-skilled people who themselves have a right to direct the affairs of the nation. This is not a bad premise, you see. That actually is the way it kind of works out, if left by its own line, in a fairly ideal state, Plato's Republic and so forth. I'll give you examples of that. It's this other thing, this thing called nobility. They are there by a God-given right, and their feet do not stink. And that means your feet do. And because their feet don't, yours do. And when their attitude is, well, my feet don't stink, as they look across the multitude which they are working or governing, they are immediately practicing an overt degradation of their fellow man and will themselves execute themselves by becoming themselves more degraded than the cattle on which they are preying. And so you have the Roman aristocracy with all their yap about the unwashed and about this and about that. You have the Roman aristocracy finally degrading in terms of virtue, using the Roman word virtue and its meaning, to a point where I don't think the dogs would have spit on them in the forum. they became far more debased than that which they were trying to debase, because we have an overt act motivator sequence going here. You run across anybody who's trying to get anything done. He's trying to get something done. He's not trying to categorize the great difference between himself and the people he faces. See that? He's not trying to categorize this. That's a perfectly safe operating frame of mind. I mean, he's getting something done, so forth. Where you find nothing getting done is where the total fixation, or nearly all of the fixation of the individual, is upon how his possessions, his riches, his position, differentiate him from those, and his main activity is in trying to impress this fact upon his fellows. And it's wonderful when you realize it, but the guy is digging his own grave sneer by sneer. Those sneers he is sneering are very ill-placed. Actually, this happens in a lifetime with rather great speed. It's under a lifetime in its length of evolution. Don't suspect that the fellow doesn't have a reason to have to insist. A fellow by the name of Shakespeare one time said, "Methinks the lady protests too much." Well, methinks the nobility protests too much. All of Europe has been made into chaos, century by century, over this. Take the 30 Years' War, the 100 Years' War, and so on. This was the whole thing, I mean. It wasn't anybody trying to get anything done. It was somebody trying to unsneer and outsneer somebody else. And how noble we were, you know. Wonderful fellows. Now, where you run into this, you run into political turmoil. Wherever you find this, wherever a set of individuals has set themselves up to be the thing, the social stuff, and so on, we find this because they set themselves up from a need to differentiate because they were afraid they were. You see, that's a different thing, you know, than just being a good guy or being an able person or being beautiful or something of this sort, just being something. This is being something against something. Get that single difference there. So all these emotions which categorize that of being something against something bring a person down into the use of energy and messed flows and a dependency upon the messed universe. The stock market crash in the United States as of 1929, wasn't it? I wasn't in the country at the time. Was itself an interesting manifestation, not of overproduction, but of the final collapse of capitalism. We don't have capitalism anymore. People don't even know what capitalism is in this modern decade. They don't know what capitalism is. They go around, they talk about a capitalist and so forth. A capitalist is a breed of cat. Capitalism is a specific philosophy. It would be an amazing thing if somebody, sometime or another, were actually to put out a book which defined these various isms in their three states of their philosophic definition, their practical activity, how they were actually conducted, and their ideological propagation use. You know, what is a capitalist according to a communist? Well, there's a certain statement that can be made about this. What is capitalism in a philosophic sense? Another statement can be made about this. What is actually capitalism in operation? And another statement can be made about this. You see, you've got three categories there. If you did this with all these isms, the darndest amount of political fog would clear up and waft away. People talk about communists. They don't know what a communist is. They don't know what a communist is dedicated to. I swear, probably some large percentage of the Communist Party itself The card-carrying boys, they don't know what a communist is. They don't know what they're supposed to do or what it's really dedicated to or so forth. They're just going around hoping that somebody will drop a crumb or a dog biscuit that they can pick up. And they're sort of there for the ride. They haven't any idea whither this goes. Now, the same way with capitalism. Capitalism is the process, of course, of loaning money, which, by accruing interest, will support a person in leisure. That is capitalism. It's capital, investment. It means that the money works and the individual doesn't work because the money's working. That's the most elementary sort of a definition of capitalism. There was a very odd that there was a tribe of Indians in the United States. Some say before the arrival of white men, but they should reclassify that and say before the arrival of pilgrims. Before 1602 or something on that, or 1608, whenever they arrived. Because that whole coast was in good communication with Europe for many centuries. Fishing boats from northern Europe used to come over to the Grand Banks all the time. As a matter of fact, the fishermen called it America. We read a big fog about Columbus and all the rest of it. I'm sure Columbus came over. Columbus never got to America. Well, anyhow, this is all very confused. But that's history. The Indians up there in Maine had a system of loaning capital for interest. They charged an interest rate for loan capital. I had that system even in operation then, but it was inherited from Europe, got over by contagion. It's quite a philosophy, but you follow this philosophy out, and it says what? It says there must be a bunch of people present who have the ambition not to work. Ooh. Why, the common denominator of psychosis and neurosis is an inability to work. Oh, you mean a part of the society going nuts. Well, it's just about what happens. And they run their cycle. And just like psychotics will do, they die off. They've got to loan money and then live on the interest rate of the money. This is about the tamest sort of a safe activity a fellow could get into, he would suppose. And then all of a sudden, crash, down goes the stock market or something of this sort. Actually, a whole class of people was wiped out at that stock market crash. It was a class that has never reappeared. The United States is still trying to adjust itself to it. England wiped out its capitalism a long time ago. But they've been doing it with great thoroughness, latterly, by the simple expedient of prohibiting income and outgo of funds. A capitalist is lost if you paralyze his dollar or his pound, because that's all it works for him. Second, you regulate the dollar, the pound, capitalism goes by the boards. Anyway, the government becomes the only capitalistic unit involved, and it proceeds to earn without working. And governments that earn without working, they go by the boards, too. Anything that earns without working goes by the boards because something is eschewing the use of effort. As soon as you say effort's no good and I'm not going to use it anymore, well, you're done. Well, how do people get sideways so they don't use this effort anymore? The only reason I brought up capitalism, I don't care about capitalism one way or the other. I soon shoot a capitalist. It's not. I mean, I could leave him alone. The effort band, then, is sort of defiled the second that we bring in these nobility against, an emotion where we will be noble against the possible degradation which we might suffer if we permitted ourselves to be associated with or connected with these people which we're in total communication with continually. I mean, it's not going to. You just try to work that one out in terms of what communication is and duplication. It just doesn't work out. All right. Or another type of society, the military type of society, whereby the only reason I mention these two things, really, courage and nobility, they are the two guiding stars, you might say, of a society in any time and period. We have always the military and the businessman, those two categories, you see. A social strata based upon control and ownership of production facilities, and the other one is ability to use the produce of a land, because one is able to demonstrate more courage in the face of danger. And so we have the military, more courage in the face of danger, and the social, aristocratic, capitalist, I don't care what you call it, strata, which is demonstrating a nobility against the mob. Now, one way or the other, these two things will get snarled up. And those two things are both parasitic upon effort. Neither one of these characters actually want to put out any real effort. So these emotions, then, to some degree or another, are blockers on the subject of effort. The deification of courage, that's the military. The deification of my feet don't stink, sort of an attitude, is, well, any number of philosophies. And both of these units, you might say the capitalist unit, the communist, by the way, is a military group, a military-type group, which desires to be parasitic upon the workers. The goal of both of these groups, the military, the communist, is to eat without production. In other words, that's to be parasitic. That's what a germ does. It becomes parasitic. And I don't think you'll find that germs are in very good state. The survival potential of a germ is terribly tenuous. He overgages a little bit and knocks off his host. He undergages a little bit and gets knocked off himself. Latterly, there are many diseases, for instance, which have disappeared from the knowledge of men. Some of these diseases have actually disappeared. They're just not heard of anymore. Well, now there's an example. A disease disappears. What's a disease? A disease is a parasitic something which feeds off a host which produces. And we have then a condition whereby a production unit is terribly inhibited by somebody trying to feed off of it without producing anything for it. You see what man is arguing about when he argues about politics. He's objecting to production being accomplished and then feasted off of by non-producers. And he's continually in a state whereby he's trying to remedy this political situation. He's trying to prevent this. And he's having a rough time doing it. And he's always falling prey to units and groups, cliques, cartels, monopolies, regiments, which, of course, just say, well, go on and produce, and we'll bleed you white. Now, therefore, we're dealing then with this business about courage and nobility. We're dealing then with parts of parasitic philosophy, which themselves divorce the individual from any real desire to go into the band of effort. This becomes very apparent as you run this. It's why the individual doesn't want to work, so forth. There isn't any reason why work has to be arduous. You know, you can produce things and you don't have to sweat over it. Well, in both of these philosophies are put into the breach to prevent people from producing. Then they're used as preventers against production. Well, an operating thetan produces. If he can't produce easily on an effort band, he's having a bad time of it. He has to be able to produce force particles. Not just deliver force particles that he gets someplace else, he has to be able to produce a force particle. And if he can't produce one and handle it, he can't operate. And there is the soul of his operation. Well, if he's got computations about having to be courageous, then he has computations about how force particles can be dangerous to him. And so he immediately slides him out of the effort band and under the effort band and making the subject of effort. And he becomes the effect of effort. Now we take nobility And if we indoctrinate him into an enormous belief that he has to hold himself aloof from entities, demons, bodies, all kinds of bad situations, oh, we've got him indoctrinated that he's better than this sort of thing, we have immediately, again, divorced him out of the force band. And his ability to act depends upon his ability to produce and handle force. See that? So how do we get an individual into a situation where he can handle force? We teach him he has to be courageous, or we teach him that he's better than and has to be noble. Those are just two ways to go about it. There are many ways to go about it. Now let me show you a very practical application of this sort of thing. You guys, ever since that nothingness was run on you the other night, I've been having a good time with the sniffles. You've been having a real good time with the sniffles, haven't you? Coughing and snoring around. All right. Now, let's hit this just a little bit practically here on the subject of courage. Now, put courage, mock up some courage. Don't the rest of you do this. Just the people who have the sniffles, please. The rest of you, put your anchor points on the back corner of the room and don't think or something, or just watch the observation, but let's not do this. I don't want the whole class down with colds. And put courage in the face of respiratory ills. Mock it up. Now mock up masses of it, masses of courage. Just the emotion. Put it up there again. Put it up again. Don't pay any attention to it after you put it up. Just let it go. Let it drift into the bank or do anything it wants to. Keep putting it up there. Courage in the face of respiratory ills. Now, the rest of you can put up courage in the face of coughing preclears. Put it up there. Masses of it. And again and again and again. Lots of it. What's turning up?
All the years of Remy's asthma.
All the years of Remy's asthma. Courage in the face of respiratory health. Let's put them up there. Asthma itself is courage in the face of not breathing this. Courage in the face of death will come down to asthma any day of the week. See how this is going? You feel better? Feel angry? Well, let's not worry about the anger. Put up courage in the face of respiratory ills. You'll find this inevitably drift into lower emotional bands. You have to continue to remind the preclear to put up courage. It's just as though the whole bank was held together on courage by this emotion alone, and by running this emotion alone, the whole bank comes to pieces. Or by running nobility. You'll find that it's just sort of the particles are like admiration particles. This is another manifestation, not unlike admiration. It's a solvent. And one, when he's unable to produce this solvent, can't resolve effort. See, it has way up at the top a very practical use. It simply wipes out somebody else's illness. Then we begin to categorize it as courage against, and that is immediately down one step. These things are all slight corruptions of the emotion called serenity. As you run this, and as you run this on a pre-clear, you keep tapping every once in a while, serenity. Well, if he can put up serenity up there, it'll drift down into the rest of it. And the key emotion, of course, is serenity. But make sure he's putting serenity up there, not being relaxed. One of the ways to get him to understand serenity is having put courage and nobility up in masses for a long time. And all of a sudden, serenity will show up and he'll recognize it. Okay. Find the feet under your floor. All right. Now, you see how this is run? Any question about how this is run? Yeah, you just keep doing that. How long do you keep doing that? Is the other one? Well, you could keep doing this on a pre-clear probably for a couple hundred hours. And if you do it on a pre-clear for 5 hours, you'll change his personality. Now, very often you'll find a pre-clear terrified of something. And that terror will vanish when you run courage in the face of it. Mm-hmm. Fellow's terrified of dental operations, you just having put up courage against various dental instruments. And it'll disappear. It's a solvent.
Would you just keep mopping it up with different things growing up courage against?
Mm. Right. You don't have to be specific. Yeah. And it's better not to be specific at all. First it's courage, and then it's courage with contempt, and then it's courage with a little fear in it, and here we go.
When does that anger kick in?
Oh, it goes right on down, but you're not ever interested in the pre-clear's anger. You're not ever interested in a lower emotion than courage when you're running this. Sure, it shows up, all right? Let it show up. It shows up because it's dissolving.
What about somatics? If it turned on somatics,
you just ignore them. This is one of those things that you just set out to run, and you go ahead and run it.
Is it done in brackets?
No. It's, after all, a quantity. This is a different type of thing, you see. What you're doing is injecting a particle into a bank.